And here we are back. Welcome to the second segment here. We're talking with Joseph P. Farrell about the secret space program and breakaway civilization, both in terms of Joseph's work, of course, but also the upcoming conference. And we're having a really interesting conversation here about basically disclosure and some of the things that have occurred here more recently. And it strikes me when we talked about this in terms of the nuclear tests and some of the things that have been going on, and the developments up to the point where we are now, how long it has taken us, I guess, to get to a certain point. And my question has always been if that is for a specific reason. Certainly we have the official world and then we have the secret world. And as we know, we can have tremendously different developments occurring within these. But nonetheless, if we look at the official level and the way that we've been kind of dragged along in this process to a certain extent, it's remarkable how long it has taken, considering what you mentioned about the moon, for example, and the fact that they might already have established bases there. There might have already been pretty much something that is workable and doable, but yet we're being held so far behind. What do you think is the main reasoning behind that, Joseph?
Well, that's the question, and my response to it, Henrik, has always been along the lines that the real problem for these technocratic elites has not been so much the problem that they don't want to release this technology. The real problem has been that some of it is so very easily weaponizable. And given the nature of the technology, I mean, let's be frank. If you have a technology that's capable of engineering the fabric of local space-time on the laboratory bench, you know, like I've said many times in connection with the Nazi Bell research I've done, anytime you have a capability like that, if you weaponize it, you have the potential of a destructive technology that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. It's hugely destructive. And, you know, we don't even really have to go to the Nazi Bell to understand that they are engineering the fabric of local space-time on the laboratory bench, because if you go to phys.org, do a search on phys.org's website for something called temporal cloaking, all right? What they've actually been able to do now in the laboratory is to cloak events, to remove events from a small little timeline. And that's huge. That's huge. You know, we don't even need to bring Nazi Bell or any of those speculations into the picture. This is an admission that they're engineering space-time locally on the laboratory bench. And therefore, you're seeing disclosed publicly technologies, or I should say conceptual complexes, that if you think about it, if you think about the implications of what they're doing, this is precisely what they're telling you. We are now doing things that can lead to field propulsion technologies, to massive engineering at a quantum level, and so on and so forth. And again, to a weaponization potential that is horrible to think about. So the problem for the elites has been proliferation. That's the problem. Now, I suspect what we're looking at, as we've been watching the push in public for 3D printing and manufacturing, you know, just stop and think of the advantages of 3D printing for a space program. And this has already been done. I'm not talking about something now that is in the future. It's already been done. Imagine the capability to scan an object on one planet and 3D print it here.
Yeah, right.
Well, this has already been done. NASA's already 3D printed something that they photographed on Mars, and they wanted to take a closer look, so they just printed up a copy.
So, amazing.
You know, this is coming down the pike, and I suspect what's going on geopolitically is that the technology genie is out of the bottle. This is something that cannot be stopped now. So they're trying to position themselves where they can influence the direction it's going to take. And I suspect that with all the talk about asteroid defense and so on and so forth, what's really going on is they're trying to set up or create the climate of opinion to set up some sort of international agency or board or whatever to not only release the technology, but to be able to monitor it, to prevent proliferation, to prevent it falling into the wrong hands, and so on and so forth. I suspect this is what we're really seeing here. And the other thing we have to consider is the energy problem. Japan, in the last year, Henrik, Japan has made some really stunning announcements that, you know, as always, fall right off of the mainstream media's radar.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, they just don't think of stories like this as being newsworthy, but I think they're huge. Japan, earlier this year, or maybe late last year, I forget when, had an architectural firm announce that they wanted to turn the moon. Please note my words.
Yep.
Turn the moon into a big solar power plant. They literally had an architectural firm draw up a study for spanning the entire equator of the moon with solar panels and beaming the power to Earth in the form of microwaves. Voila, energy problem solved, at least for Japan.
Right,
<You know>? No more dependency on oil, no more dependency on America to protect the oil, you know, on and on we could go.
Mm.
Well, no sooner had Japan done this, you know, and when I saw this story, I just thought, oh, Death Star. And no sooner had Japan released the story than about 3 or 4 days later, China came out and said, yeah, we want to turn the moon into a big, huge solar Death Star. So in other words, the Chinese read the Japanese, the implications of the Japanese announcement correctly, because the same technology can be easily weaponized, all right?
Yep.
Now, in the last 2 weeks, Japan came out again with another plan. Okay, maybe not turn the moon into a big, huge solar power plant. Let's just put up orbital stations, big, huge orbital solar power plants, and beam the energy to the Earth in the form of microwaves, okay?
Yeah.
And, you know, Japan's reasoning here is crystal clear. They do need a source of energy that's clean in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. They need a source of energy that's not dependent on oil imports and so on and so forth. You know, we're dealing with a huge manufacturing economy. So, you know, their reasoning is understandable. But if you look at what they're talking about, and I cover this in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, this idea of putting up big, huge solar power plants and beaming the microwave energy down to Earth has been around since the 1960s. It was first proposed by the U.S. military. And the drawback, of course, to this idea is to collect the microwave energy on the surface of this planet, you would have to basically have dead zones, quite literally, of about 140 square kilometers, where you'd set up antenna arrays, but nothing inside this region where you're beaming the microwaves to would live. I mean, literally,
exactly.
You'd be cooking a certain part of the Earth. So the idea has been around for a long time. What's interesting is that this plan received almost no comment other than from China in the international media. So in other words, I think that they are pushing now, quietly, the idea of alternative sources of energy, you know, and the sun is the most big and obvious one that we have, and it's nearly inexhaustible. We're already in the realm, Henrik, of talking about a class two type civilization, you know, converting the entire energy of a star to fulfill energy requirements. And that's something I think coming down the pike. It's not stoppable. It's just, how are we going to handle all of this? How are we going to ensure that these technologies are not converted into horrendous weapons? But it is coming down the pike. And it's going to change by the nature of the case, obviously. You know, we've got this big, huge ball of energy that floats over our heads every day that we take for granted. And if we are successful in utilizing that energy on a global scale, look at what happens to our current system of finance.
Look
at what happens to the geopolitics of the world. The countries that have that technology, have access to space technologies to put it up there, are going to be the big players on the block. So, you know, we're entering not only a new era in terms of our energy technologies, but we're entering an era of geopolitical thinking that's going to be unlike anything we've encountered before in human history, totally unlike anything. So I think they're putting into, if you watch these stories carefully, Henrik, I think they're starting to release these technologies that have been developed in the black world. Again, look at 3D printing. I'm convinced that this comes from the black world. It's been around for, you know, a couple of decades. So why the big push now? Well, I think the big push is quite literally they are trying to disperse manufacturing. And my thinking there is, well, why?
Right.
Why, you know, why do they need to disperse sophisticated manufacturing? And the only thing I can think of, Henrik, is that this is a strategic plan. I go back to World War II. Look what Albert Speer did inside of Germany under, you know, the Allied and Soviet bombing assault. What he was doing was he was dispersing manufacturing plants and putting them underground and producing everything modularly.
Right.
You know, they were building these U-boats, you know, one part here, one part there, all, you know, in these dispersed locations, and then just shipping the parts to the shipyards where they were, you know, welded together.
Yeah.
Producing thousands of jet aircraft entirely underground. I think this
remarkable
is something similar.
Yeah.
It's a military response that we're looking at, and I have to ask why. So they're releasing all of this slowly, and it has all the appearance to me, Henrik, of part of some great big strategic design that they're putting into play. And it's going to change everything. It really is.
Now, there's a lot of other things I want to run by you here, but let's return to what you talked earlier about the Tower of Babel moment here and what you think would be. Let's say we took a wrong step and what actually would happen. And I'm reminded, I'm going to bring up another thing here as well. And I can't recall if I brought this by you last time you were on or not. It might have been later in the process that we put this up on the website, but it's something called the ITER, the International Thermonuclear Experiment Reactor, something that they're going to build on, you know, I think it was in France somewhere or the border
France,
there again.
Yeah.
Just a remarkable, totally scary. This could kill everything on the whole planet and beyond. You know, they're basically creating a star in a bottle. That's what they were talking about here. Is that something that we're talking about? Like if they developed something like this, this might be crossing that line and ergo we would have some kind of intervention. What do you think?
Well, no, I don't think there's any danger of an intervention on the fusion energy story. I think the intervention would, quite frankly, take the form of, this is such an important question, and I have to choose my words very carefully. It would take the form of a perception that humanity was getting close to class one or class two civilization status, and therefore we better stop it because that could pose a threat. Okay.
Right.
So they have to transition to that stage without appearing threatening. But at the same time, this is why the strategic chess here is so difficult. They cannot appear to be in a position of weakness vis-a-vis a phenomenon that throughout its history since World War II has demonstrated provocative, if not hostile, acts, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So to do that, you have to convince whoever's behind the phenomenon that human capability is more than meets the eye. And in my way of thinking, Henrik, the way they would go about doing this, I take part of the clue from Lieutenant Colonel Corso that everybody makes fun of and no one takes very seriously. He comes out in his book The Day After Roswell and just very boldly and bluntly states that the reason for the huge, massive buildup of thermonuclear weapons by the Soviet Union, the United States, to a lesser extent, France and Great Britain, was precisely to show whoever was behind the UFO that if any invasion was attempted, we could turn the Earth into a cinder, you know, simply right. overwhelm them by sheer numbers of nuclear warheads. That, he maintains, is the hidden logic behind the Cold War. And you take that remark and put it into context, and then look what happened at the demise of the Soviet Union. All of a sudden, the United States and the Soviet Union are dismantling their thermonuclear stockpiles and reducing them dramatically by an order of magnitude, you know, so that we don't have the tens of thousands of warheads, strategic warheads that we used to, neither do the Russians, but we have better and more accurate ones, to be sure, and other toys. The other thing you're going to do in order to play this game of bluff poker is you're going to create technologies that, to use a financial term here, can leverage the appearance of being able to manipulate systems on a planetary and possibly even stellar scale. And guess what they are? They're the ionospheric heaters. Let me explain why.
Okay.
The ionospheric heaters, you know, ISCAT in Europe, HARP, that's supposedly being dismantled in this country because, you know, now we've got something better.
Exactly. That's my take. Right away, I was like, all right, they've achieved what they wanted to it. Now here we go. Version 2.0. Yeah.
Bingo.
Oh, yeah.
But these ionospheric heaters are capable of manipulating weather. And what's weather? Well, weather, like it or not, is a planetary scaled system. You know, each local weather system is interconnected with other systems. And they are able to do this by doing what? Well, by heating, you know, quote unquote, heating the ionosphere, raising a dome of energy in the ionosphere, okay? So in other words, they're tinkering with things on a planetary scale.
Yep.
That's class one civilization according to the Farrell corollary of the Kardashev scale, all right?
Right.
My corollary says you don't the civilization type can also be defined not by the amount of energy that's required, but rather by your ability to manipulate systems at each of those scales, planetary, stellar, and galactic, all right? So on that scale, then yeah, we're looking at class one civilization capability already. But here's the curveball. When you're heating the ionosphere, what are you really doing? Well, you're playing around with the Earth's magnetosphere.
Yep.
What's the magnetosphere? It's the thing that protects all of us, all life, not just human life, but all life on this planet from deadly radiation that's cascading down on us every second from the sun. So therefore, because the Earth's magnetosphere, you can go online and look at these recent papers from NASA that have concluded that there is a relationship of the Earth's magnetosphere to the sun. They're even talking in terms of a kind of a common surface between the two with a portal.
A corridor, you know, yeah.
A corridor, yes, yeah. Exactly. So in other words, it is conceivable then that by manipulating the Earth's magnetosphere, you can set up, you know, through the phenomenon of resonance, that you can set up some sort of resonance effect on the sun. Okay.
Huh.
So, yeah, that's a big one. That's a whopper. That's a doozy.
Sure, yeah.
So, in other words, these same technologies, in my opinion, could possibly, by dint of this relationship between the Earth and the sun's magnetosphere, these things could possibly set up either intended or unintended resonance effects on the sun. And I'll crawl way out on the twig of speculation here, Henrik. I think that some of these experiments that they've been running with these heaters have been precisely to see what sort of resonance effects they might be able to get from the sun. So, you know, in other words, look at when ISCAT is active, and are there solar events that correspond to the same time frame?
Well, exactly. I remember seeing weird things that I haven't seen before, like the tsunami type effects and everything else on the sun. You know, it's like very bizarre and interesting things. And I wanted to ask you something else here, pertaining to this, obviously. But is this ultimately maybe then not about us having to do it because we are so eager to learn about what happens or whatever? Is this rather about us having to show off, you know, showing off and saying, look at what we can do. Look, master, I can, I can do this and that.
Right? I think it's the latter. It's about gunboat diplomacy.
Right.
That's precisely what I think it's about.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Let's go back to something I mentioned in Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations. You know, you had in the late 1990s, or maybe it was early in this millennium, Norman Berggren in his little book called The Ringmakers of Saturn, in which he takes the old Voyager photographs of strange things in Saturn's rings and concludes, well, these are great big huge machines, and they're doing something with that planet and on some of its satellites. Well, you stop and think about that, you know, at first glance, that just sounds harebrained and kooky. But we're dealing here with a man that had good scientific credentials and had connections to NASA. In other words, what his book really represents is the kind of out-of-the-box thinking of considering all sorts of possibilities that have to be going on inside of the breakaway civilization secret space program group. They have to consider the possibility that these anomalies might not be unknown natural phenomena, but rather artificial. And if that's the case, then you're going to want to make a demonstration that humanity has the capability of manipulating systems on planetary and possibly stellar scales, you know, class 2 scale in the feral corollaries to the Kardashev scheme. So yeah, my thinking, Henrik, is that we are looking at technologies that have been developed not simply because of normal human scientific curiosity, but rather because there was a certain urgency and necessity to do so. That's exactly what I think happened.
So the dialogue, to a certain extent, then must have been open. The information must have been shared of what was sought of us to be achieved at some point, correct?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, again, let me give an illustration here, going back to your idea of international cooperation. All right?
Yeah.
Back in the early 1970s, late 1960s, as the first SALT I treaty was being negotiated by Brezhnev and Nixon, the Soviet delegation, this was reported by Lieutenant Colonel Tom Bearden, and I tend to believe him, he maintains that the Soviet delegation approached the Americans that they wanted to include in the treaty protocols banning other more massive weapons of mass destruction. In other words, the Soviets were thinking in terms of technologies that could manipulate weather, technologies that could obsolesce, if not render completely obsolete, the entire thermonuclear arsenal, that they wanted to limit, and I believe this was explicitly mentioned by Bearden at some point, wanted to limit technologies that were capable of manipulating the sun. And at the time, Bearden mentions that the American response to the negotiating team was, you know, kind of mystification. Are the Russians nuts? Are they crazy? What are they talking about?
Right.
But in reality, I think what was really going on behind the scenes was probably, yes, both sides knew that these types of technologies were possible, that they were within human technological grasp, and that what they were really trying to do was set up some sort of protocol to monitor each other's development and create a kind of exotic technology hotline, as it were, such as a similar hotline capability that was developed with respect to thermonuclear weapons. That's what I really suspect is going on. So that means that at a very high level and at a very secret level, there are secret protocols to all these strategic weapons agreements between the West and Russia, probably including China at some point. And it also means that there is a mechanism of international cooperation at an extremely secret level to monitor how those technologies might be used in certain, let's put it this way, in certain interplanetary diplomatic situations.
Right. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, in other words, I don't think you're going to see Europe with ISCAT or the United States with HARP or the Japanese with their arrays or the Russians with theirs taking unilateral action in response to some perceived interplanetary problem with those technologies without consulting the other partners to the protocols.
Right.
I think that coordination probably already exists at a very high level of necessity, because again, the geopolitical situation on Earth, you can't afford a miscalculation. I mean, if we can't afford a miscalculation with hydrogen bombs and hence set up a hotline between the president and the Russian president, then by the nature of the case, we are going to be even more careful with regards to technologies that are potentially much more destructive than hydrogen bombs.
Yeah, exactly. Now, might there be factions within this international community that has established, you know, contact with the others, what have you, that still are, you think, have a dual play here? Because some part of me is also kind of wondering here, you know, okay, let's say that we step up to reach, you know, that class three of a civilization. I know that that's far away, but let's say we're soon we get there. Is this the Tower of Babel moment, or are we? I guess what I'm asking in a way is that the question is whom is dictating to whom here? And if I'm troubled by this question that there might be people, an international community, doing things on this planet because of their excitement to try to get into some kind of galactic community and doing it above the heads of the rest of the population. And at the same time, look at the mayhem and the issues that there are, if that indeed is side effects, but I believe they are, that they're creating on the rest of this planet to just try to achieve this goal of theirs, right?
Yeah, I totally am in agreement with you, Henrik. And I think, I'll be very frank and crawl away out onto the limb again here. I think that to a certain extent, that is what you're looking at. I'm looking at a foreign policy in the United States that, to me, geopolitically, and I talked a great deal about this last night with George Ann Hughes on her show, that makes absolutely no sense. None.
Yeah.
I mean, the most recent development is that now all of a sudden Argentina wants to join the BRICS bloc. So in other words, the United States appears to be pushing some powerful, technologically sophisticated countries away from it. And I, you know, simply by this crazy, nutty, unipolar agenda.
Right.
And it makes no geopolitical sense to me. And at some level, I think there may be, as you have suggested, operative, a group or faction within that international community that has access to these things and may have or is seeking somehow to establish some sort of contact with these things. And the other side of this coin that I think is equally frightening, Henrik, is we must remain open in terms of how we construe the UFO phenomenon. In other words, I don't think, and I don't think that the national security apparatus thought or thinks, that the UFO phenomenon is entirely or exclusively a unified phenomenon. It is rather a set of phenomena,
yeah,
one of which could be a nuts and bolts technology from somewhere else. But the other aspect of it, as Dr. Jacques Vallée has been pointing out assiduously and arguing over the years, is that some aspects of this phenomena appear to be spiritual in nature rather than technological.
Right, yeah.
And as a consequence of that, in my thinking, what the breakaway group or secret space program group, whatever you wish to call it, have attempted to do is investigate that angle of things and attempt to communicate via means that you and I would call occult or esoteric. I think this is what you might be looking at even with crop circles. I don't view these things as exclusively an extra or non-terrestrial phenomenon. I think part of them are definitely products of human technology. But they may be attempting to accomplish several things with one technology here on the human side, and that's some form of communication. Again, you have Mr. Hoagland's model of the ritual aspects of certain events that happened in our space program, you know, the Apollo planning and so on.
Right. Yeah.
All of these things suggest that there's another aspect, there's a secret aspect to the public space program, and that secret aspect is precisely connected with esoteric themes, ritual, and so on. The space program is the perfect vehicle to accomplish, let's be blunt, to accomplish ceremonial magic on a planetary scale. So there's that aspect of things. I think the Tower of Babel moment problem, I think we've made it through the initial stage of that very dicey moment in human history, because I think that it is clear that we've developed some sort of technologies that are workable on a planetary and possibly stellar scale, and can demonstrate and use that technology, and have done so. And again, I go back to something that Colonel Corso said in his book, and again, you know, most people don't take him seriously anymore. I tend to, because he also said in his book that by the end of the Reagan administration, the UFO phenomenon, and by that I think he means the nuts and bolts aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
was stalemated, that we were successful in our gunboat diplomacy in stalemating the phenomenon. So, you know, yeah, I'm with you. I think that there's a real danger of a rogue group taking decisions for all of humanity. I'll be honest with you, Henrik. I think that there is a very good possibility that at meetings like the Bilderbergers and so on, these elites realize that at a significant level, they're no longer the big players on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I think they realize that by getting in bed after World War II with the intelligence agencies, that even their ability to control and manipulate the financial markets has fallen out of their hands, that there's another player on the block, it's a human player, and that they're calling the shots, and that there's aspects of that whole community that they're no longer privy to. I strongly suspect that in their most secretive discussions, and we see indicators of this with the interest in this country, for example, of the Rockefeller family in the UFO phenomenon, I think that interest is there, not simply out of their curiosity about the subject, but it comes probably, in my opinion, ultimately, from a realization that this phenomena has something to do with the fact that their power is waning.
Right, yeah.
And that they are not being told everything from their contacts in the national security establishment, that certain other people in that establishment, most likely connected with the defense corporations, know and aren't talking about. I'm convinced that the Western global elite at a certain level knows that there are other human players on the block that they are no longer able to influence or control. And that has them panicked.
Is
rightly
the,
so.
Yeah, well, exactly, of course. And at the same time, then the question is here, because I can't put my finger on it, but just as you said, in terms of the weird, bizarre decisions we see on the geopolitical level, even how things are the contradictions within what we see is happening, you know, the push towards globalism and, like, you know, world government and everything else. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, we have, you know, like a power faction within the West that allegedly is running all this. And then at the same time, they make counterintuitive decisions, something that's, you know, ultimately is going to lead to their own destruction, etc. I mean, there are a lot of these things that just doesn't seem to make sense, you know,
yes.
And that's kind of where I'm at right now in terms of, like, okay, who is really pulling the strings here, and why are they doing this? I mean, this is something I guess you were trying to kind of outline in your Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, right?
Yes, and I'm in, again, Hendrik, I'm in total agreement. The counterintuitive nature of what we see happening in the scale of global geopolitics is just breathtaking, particularly on the part of the West. And I strongly suspect, and I have been saying this all along, that there's a hidden factor in play here that accounts for all of this. And I suspect that it has precisely to do with your hypothesis that there is a group of people that have access to technologies and information and are acting upon it and are pushing, particularly in the West, in a certain direction for whatever reason that they haven't publicly disclosed yet. And I do think that all of these weird space stories, you know, the Pope, Medvedev, NASA with its internet experiments and 3D printing objects from other planets so that they can have a closer look at it. Here, well, Hendrik, why would you 3D print a rock?
Yeah, why would you?
Exactly. I suspect that that's the cover story, and that the real story is they saw something and, you know, went around, took multiple pictures of it, and printed it up to have a closer look.
Artifacts, something.
Yes, yeah. Bingo, ding, ding, ding,
yeah.
Ding, ding, ding. And the same thing, incidentally, with China, with China's lunar rover. Richard Hoagland spoke on Coast to Coast recently about that incident, and I think, again, he's dead on. I think that there's something going on there with that space probe, that the Chinese found something and in their own inscrutable oriental way let everybody know in the West that they found something. You know? So, yeah, I think the game's afoot. I really do. And it's going to be interesting to watch the news geopolitically to see how all of this is gradually going to come out. And again, I suspect you're going to start seeing, let's put it this way, Hendrik, we can make a prediction here for your listeners. If your hypothesis is true, that there is a group within this secret space program structure, breakaway civilization, whatever you wish to call it, if they are behaving in the fashion that you suggest, then we are going to see an attempt by the elites that have been shut out of that to find out what it is. And I suspect that what they're going to do is try and leverage public opinion to pry it loose.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect that we can look at the powers that be, you know, the typical players that everybody thinks of, and watch them very closely in the coming months and years and how they promote certain things on the media, in particular. I think that's going to be a huge clue to whether or not your hypothesis has walking legs. And from my point of view, I think it does.
Let's see if we can just detail a bit more about the factions here and the breakdown of this, how you see this. If you see basically two rivaling mad, you know, factions that are basically, you know, trying to go for the prize here and getting control, obviously, to achieve the higher objective. And again, I guess we have to say whatever that might be at this stage, because we're still in the position of speculating a lot about this. But how do you break down the different factions and the struggles between them? Is this something within where you take sides, for example, and say, okay, I this makes more sense than the other suggestion over here, or something like that?
No, I don't see. I don't take any sides, because I'm kind of in the same boat as you and everyone else. I'm an outsider. You know, I'm a hack from South Dakota looking at all this. And what I think, faction wise, that you're dealing with, you can boil it down to functional and then geopolitical factions. In other words, the major European powers are always going to have a certain factional interest representing their geopolitical interests. France's interests are going to be different than Italy's and so on. But you have the European interest. Then you have the functional interests. You've got international finance, you've got international corporations. And then, above all, within that structure, I think you have the major defense contractors, Saab in Sweden, Messerschmitt in Germany, Dassault, you know, British Aerospace, Rocketdyne, Lockheed, all these contractors that by dint of the case are going to be involved in the secret research aspect of this. And the same holds true inside of Russia. So you're going to have those kinds of factions. Then at a very deep, high level, you're going to have the managerial coordinators that have access to the big picture. And those are going to, in my opinion, interface very closely with the intelligence structures of those nations. NSA, CIA, BND, you know, MI6, and so on. They're going to interface at a very high kind of MJ-12 working group level.
All right.
Within that, I think you're going to have probably a network of international contacts that talk to each other, and probably talk to each other on a regular basis. Now, in terms of the counterintuitive nature of what we're seeing, I suspect that part of what I've been calling the factional infighting is that they have reached an impasse, perhaps, on how to proceed from here.
Right, yeah.
I've been saying for years, I've been saying since the bailouts, that there's some aspect of the behavior, particularly within the West, of the standard elites that shows some sort of sign of duress or desperation or panic. Part of that, I think, stems from the fact that they themselves don't really know how to handle the financial mess that they've put us in. And the other part is, I think that they are slowly coming to grasp with the fact that there's a whole huge aspect of this financial thing dealing, again, with my hypothesis of a hidden system of finance that is out of their control, their control. And they want to find out what the heck is going on. So you're getting pushback from that group. So my suspicion is, and I've said this on a couple of other occasions, my suspicion is that what we're seeing is the behavior of people that are in some sort of timetable. They're in a rush to do something. And the something I think that they're in a rush to accomplish has to do with space, because we are seeing a kind of slow, steady, I wouldn't call it a flood, but we're certainly seeing a slow, steady stream of talk about space, asteroid mining, commercialization, all of this stuff. And I'll be very blunt and honest, I'll say it again. Whenever you're talking about commercialization and collateralization of space, you're talking about militarization and weaponization. Because where you have commerce, you must protect it.
Sure, yeah.
And that implies, then, if there's real commerce going on, who's it with?
Exactly. Yeah. Of course. Know?
This is what I think is going on. And it, like I say, if your hypothesis, and I'm in total agreement with it, I'll be very blunt. If your hypothesis is true that there's a rogue group taking decisions now, you know, diplomatic decisions for planet Earth, then the powers that be have been cut out of the picture. They've been cut out of the equation, and they're going to want to get back into it, and we're going to see the pushback. I think that's what, in part, we're watching. I think with all of this business about 3D printing, asteroid defense systems, and all of the chatter that's been going on kind of steady and below the radar for the last couple of years, I think that's what you're watching. I think you're seeing a certain degree of pushback from these people wanting to break into that technocratic group that has the control of the technologies and the interface with the intelligence agencies. And let me go one step further.
Please do.
I've been asking myself for a long time, what really is this NSA spying all about? Why this sudden huge interest to model and map on a planetary scale social behavior? That's really what I think, besides Secretary Fitz's idea that this is the ultimate insider financial trading mechanism, and I think at that level that's certainly true, but I think there's an even deeper level, and that's social engineering. They're gathering an enormous amount of data, which they've located in Utah,
yeah,
you know, right in the heart of the Mormon Church. Why there? And I got to thinking about that, and the only thing I can think of is bloodlines. Because the Mormon Church has an enormous database about family histories and genealogies.
That's
and so
right, exactly. They went back, they've detailed,
oh, yeah,
even people outside of, you know, their own group, I guess, right? And they've,
yes,
just, yeah,
absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
And let's crawl way out onto the end of the twig of speculation here. Why would you do that? Why would you be attempting to do that? Well, if all of the stories and indicators of the abduction experiencers who have been saying, and in some cases screaming for years, that there's some sort of alien hybrid program at work, and that they may even be amongst us now, then how do you track it? Well,
right,
you gather lots of DNA samples at road stops, at, you know, take swabs from people for no apparent reason, and start storing and building a big, huge database, and you try and map the genome of people and find out if there's anything peculiar or unusual in it.
And we might be talking about people who don't even know what they are, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think there's a big, huge hidden story squatting right out there in the open with this NSA surveillance thing. And to be quite honest, you know, all the fingers are pointing at the NSA. Well, come on, give me a break, folks. You're telling me that Great Britain doesn't have a similar capability, that France doesn't, that Russia doesn't, you know, SISMI in Italy, you know, they all do.
They all do, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, any nation with any sort of military-industrial complex has, you know, pretty good intelligence services and electronic eavesdropping capability. Japan, China, you know, India. So I'm thinking that we're looking at perhaps another big, huge part of the puzzle here. And again, I admit that's totally speculation, but I think you have to consider it. Especially given, you know, someone on my website last Friday during our vid chat sent me an email because I had told people, if you're going to prove the bloodline hypothesis from history, the thing you have to look at is heraldry. And he sent me this brilliant email and showed a picture of Ninurta from Babylon,
mm-hmm,
sitting on his throne, and right behind the throne, smack dab in this ancient Babylonian piece of art, what do you have? You have a double-headed bird.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Who does that remind you of? The Habsburgs?
Yeah.
The Romanovs? You know?
Sure, yeah.
Freemasonry uses it. Why is it there? I suspect, and I've told people this many times, I suspect that one of the hidden agendas of the Genome Project is to find out and verify if any of those stories of ancient genetic engineering are true. If they are, then there's a possibility those people might still be out there somewhere. And it's a possibility, if the abductees who've been telling us basically the same story over and over again, that, you know, their eggs or their sperm or what have you have been harvested. Well, the question is why? Is that going to be a national security issue? Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly. Of
course absolutely it is.
See, I always got the feeling that it was about that if it's something that we have contained within us, this is something that they would have, they want to seek to isolate this DNA.
Yes.
And potentially recreating whatever this actually is, right? And
yes, absolutely.
It might be something that can only be attained by a large amount of people or something like that. It's something that's
absolutely
been distributed throughout the entire population. And to get a good grasp of it, to be able to recreate it or work with it in some way, even building, you know, DNA, simulations or what have you, you have to gather all this data, right?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely. If you're going to verify that story, you're going to have to gather a lot of data. And if you're concerned about the abduction, you know, if you're concerned about the national and planetary security implications of abductees and what they have been saying for any number of years, then the other thing you're going to want to do is put into place some sort of covert program to monitor anyone that you suspect might be from somewhere else, or a hybrid of people from here and somewhere else.
Right.
So there's that aspect of it. And here's the thing, Henrik, you know, here's a real whopper. In the standard genetic model, as they're putting together their computer models of haplogroups and tracing them back to mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam, as they're called in genetics, they made an interesting discovery that's very recent. You have to go out there and dig for this, and I wish I could remember the name of the article. But in the standard genetic model, modern humanity emerges out of Africa sometime between 150 and 200,000 years ago. But lo and behold, recently, they have discovered that some human males apparently have a Y chromosome that is older than humanity. It's about 240,000 years old. And guess what? When I saw that, that rang a big bell for me, because if you go back to the Sumerian kings list, when do they tell you kingship was brought down?
Is it around
about
that?
243,000 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, wow. Huh. So, you know, all these things are out there, and I'm like you. If you're gonna verify that ancient bloodline, you know, genetic engineering story, the first thing you do is you gather lots of data. I think that's absolutely what they've been doing. But secondly, you know, going back to this secret space program, national security paradigm, if you are aware of people being abducted or claiming to be abducted, it doesn't really matter if the claims of truth are there or not. The claim itself will force you to investigate it by the nature of the case. And if you are concerned about the truth claims, well, what do? You have to set up some sort of global surveillance system in order to track who people are and where they're moving and where they're going. Combine the two, genetics and surveillance, and you've got the perfect platform to track the possibility that some of the people that you and I mix with might not ultimately be all from here.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, all of this is in play, whether we like it or not, and that ramps up considerably the factional infighting aspect of this, quite considerably.
Well, exactly.
Isn't it interesting that the Pope comes out with his announcement, oh yeah, we could baptize Martians if they asked for it.
Yeah, exactly. Just in case that would be coming up here soon. You know, they want to go to the Catholic Church and be blessed
and be
by
baptized,
the Pope.
You know, and what people are missing are the implications of what he said. Because within any sort of liturgical tradition, you know, Lutheran or Anglican or Roman Catholic or Orthodox, what have you, baptism is the entry into the sacramental life of the church. In other words, you have access to all the other sacraments, including, here it comes, including, supposedly, holy orders.
Huh. So, right.
Yeah, you know, at some point, Francis has opened the door, you see, to a big theological conundrum. Well, does that mean we can then go on to ordain Martians to the diaconate and the priesthood
right,
and the episcopacy?
Exactly. Well, exactly. But this might just be it there, then. This actually might be an understanding that, okay, we're going to work with these guys, and for us to legally, within the canon of the Catholic Church, to do this, we have to baptize them. You know? Like,
right, exactly. Well, that's precisely it. But, you know, I've been pointing out that there are certain parallels that we see going on with the Vatican aspect of this space story that, if you look carefully and closely, resemble how the Vatican handled the revelation of the New World. I mean, the elites of Europe knew about the New World at least 2 centuries prior to the revelation of it with Columbus.
Oh, certainly,
but,
yeah.
Oh yeah, but that means that the Columbus voyage was a voyage not of discovery, but it was a bit of social engineering. It was a voyage of revelation. Okay, and I cover this in my new book, incidentally, that's coming out. But you look at what was done then and compare it to what was done now, what's really going on in part is the papacy is positioning itself for a reformulation of papal claims, not simply as extensive to earth, but out there as well.
Yeah.
That's exactly what's going on.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting.
Yeah,
well,
wow.
What's the next big push here, do you think? I mean, you mentioned a couple of things to watch out for, some, you know, the developments alone in terms of the hints and, you know, as usual, in the back of the paper, not the most out there kind of stuff. Usually it's, you have to look for it a little bit, but usually the alternative media does a good job in, you know, picking up some of these stories, you know, yourself included. Mm-hmm. But where do you think, where's the next development within all of this, do you think?
Well, I frankly suspect that what we're going to see is, I think we can expect the private space companies to come out in the next few years with some breathtaking announcements of the nature, oh, we had a secret mission and it was successful and here's the results. I think we can expect some of that.
Right, yeah.
And by the nature of the case, that's going to provoke public responses from the public space agencies. That's the first thing that I think is going to happen. The next thing I think that we have to watch for are any news stories pertaining to international agreements concerning space. Now, there has been a story very recently. Russia and Argentina, for example, just recently signed protocols against the placement of weapons in outer space. Now, I don't think for a moment that either Russia or Argentina have any real interest in not weaponizing space. What I think they're doing is they're setting up the political climate to create some sort of international body. In other words, I think you're going to see a clamor for some sort of international space weapons control agency. I think that's in the cards. And I think that may be possibly the way that they will attempt to leverage other global political institutions. I think that's in the cards.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Now, do you think that, let's say we have an increase in the private space sector, is this anything that would upset the general plans of what is going on? I mean, everything seems very, in that regard, very strict. I mean, even if you monitor what some of the other countries are trying to do when it comes to, like, you know, going to the moon or mapping certain things, there's along the way, there are things that are occurring, there are hiccups. I mean, if the private space sector industry really picks up, this is something that actually could potentially reveal a lot of the things that actually have been going
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely.
Know, right. So
I think that's the game. In fact, I think the game of space privatization, in part, has been concocted to force the hand of some of the things that have been closely held secrets. And I'll tell you how I suspect this may come about. What I suspect is going to be a theme that we're going to see regarding space in the next couple of decades, international boards, international agencies with real clout. I suspect that this is really going to start surfacing with respect to the moon and with respect to Mars. You already have people, believe it or not, that are buying property, buying mineral rights on Mars.
Yeah. Mm.
So there's going to have to be a consensus, an international consensus emerge on how we handle things. And trust me, given the culture of the Brookings Report with its reference to artifacts, okay?
Yeah.
If we start seeing in these international discussions conventions on how to deal with encounters of artifacts and who owns them, that's the giveaway right there, in my opinion, that the game is afoot. If they start talking about this publicly in international forums, I go back to my model. If it's public discussion, the activity has already been done. So if we start seeing that as one of the concerns in this emerging predicted international space talk about establishing agencies, inevitably they're going to have to start thinking in terms of artifacts and how to handle them and who has jurisdiction over them. And that will be yet another way to leverage a global governmental style institution. You know, the Planetary Commission for Antiquities.
Well, exactly. And I mean, and think about it from this perspective as well. I mean, this is not, there's going to be plenty of fights over this stuff. I mean, history,
I
mean, even human history in itself is sensitive. Just look at things like the Kennewick man, you know, or something like that over in the U.S. and how that was treated and potential, you know, Viking remains in North America. And, you know, even that level of fighting between these things, imagine if we have something, you know, extraterrestrial or something even, you know, that pertains to our own development as humans or anything like that. That's not going to be an easy thing to solve, I think, right?
No, it's not going to be easy at all. And again, I'm with Richard Hoagland in his analysis of that Chinese Jade Rabbit lander and what they may have found and how they chose to disclose it. The game is afoot, and I think that, again, probably the Chinese have found something up there. I think definitely the Europeans have found things that they haven't told in their Martian probes and their probes to the asteroids. And that there are probably already high-level discussions about how are we going to handle all of this. I really don't think, at least at this stage of the game, I don't think it's going to be the cause for wars or anything, because I think all the players concerned recognize that there's much more at stake here. At least I would hope they do.
Yeah, exactly.
But I tend to think that at that level, sanity tends to prevail when you're talking about things of affecting the entire planet, in fact, affecting the entire human race.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Chinese aren't stupid. They're not irrational. Neither are the Russians, you know, or the French or anybody else that has a concern in outer space. So it's going to be an interesting thing to watch in the next few years. And I think we have to, I think we have to put on our thinking caps and literally scour for any story that's space related and attempt to understand it in terms of this kind of wide context I've been painting here.
Well, exactly. I mean, very interesting. I hope that this is some of the things, of course, as well, we'll get to talk more about at the conference and, you know, collaborate, of course, between the different researchers and again, yeah, all, you know, using our brains in this regard and actually try to figure out and get closer to some of these answers, because it is there. And as we know, if we do ask the, the right questions and kind of put things in right context, the pieces of the puzzle actually do fall in place. And that's what's so valuable, of course, in situations like these. So,
right.
But Joseph, very interesting. Thank you again for your time. As we begin then to wrap things up for this time, of course, we're looking forward to seeing you in San Mateo as well for the conference.
Yeah, it'll
there.
Be fun. It'll be fun to meet.
Definitely, exactly. And I want to give out some of the websites for that as well. SecretSpaceProgram.org. Go there to get your tickets. And of course, if you're a member, don't forget to grab the discount code from RedEyesMembers.com before you order those tickets. And I do hope we see many of you guys there. It's going to be a lot of fun. Tell us about the new book you have coming out as well, Joseph, and give us your website once more.
Yeah, the new book is called Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age. It's a book about history, some hidden history of the Middle Ages and Renaissance. It's also a book about hermetic ideas in the arts and music and politics. And then it goes way back at the very end of the book to connections to Egypt that most people are going to be, I think, stunned once they read it. So that's the book coming out. My website is www.gizadestar.com. It's all one word, all lowercase, and you can get the books there. I haven't put the new book up on my web store yet, but I'm planning to in the next couple of days.
All right, very good. New stuff coming out. Keep an eye on gizadestar.com. Thank you again, Joseph.
Thanks for having me back, Andrew.
You bet. We'll see you soon.
Yep, bye-bye.
Well, I hope we can see you in San Mateo later this month. Please grab the ticket discount code in the member section for the Secret Space Program Conference and get ready for a great event and get a chance to, you know, connect with a lot of people that are on the same topic as well. Or, you know, get out of your headspace a bit, get out of the house or the apartment and engage a bit. It's always good and always fun. We'll have some Q&A sessions as well at the end of each day. Kind of a main discussion with everybody really that's been talking that day. Always good chances as well to socialize and connect with some people as well. I think it'll be a great event. All right, but that's at the end of this month. Before that, we'll talk more with Richard Dolan for an update on the breakaway civilization, Vahan Setyan to talk about the unknown aspects of Armenian history and the Armenian genocide. We'll also have Joseph Atwill to discuss the typology of Shakespeare as a reversal of the Gospels, a document of revenge. We'll also discuss who the real author was. We also have Felice Vinci and William Mullen on the Baltic origins of Homer's epic tales. Very interesting theory. We also have John Rappaport, David Matheson, Carol Rosen, and many, many more coming on the program. All right, well, thank you very much for listening today. Thank you so much for being a member. We appreciate your support. Couldn't do this without you guys. Lots of warm thanks and appreciation goes out to all of you guys and gals out there. All right, we'll speak to you more in just a few days. Have a great weekend, everybody. Take it easy, relax, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.